yet it would have been considered the height of rudeness to refuse any of the dishes, carefully prepared for the endless banquets in my honor. In India, nowhere else, alas, a well-padded swami is considered a delightful sight. After dinner, Keshabananda led me to a secluded nook. "Your arrival is not unexpected," he said. "I have a message for you." I was surprised. No one had known of my plan to visit Keshabananda. While roaming last year in the northern Himalayas near Badrinagar, the Swami continued, "I lost my way. Shelter appeared in a spacious cave, which was empty, though the embers of a fire glowed in a hole in the rocky floor. Wandering about the occupants of this lonely retreat, I sat near the fire, my gaze fixed on the sunlit entrance to the cave. Keshabananda, I am glad you are here." These words came from behind me. I turned, startled, and was dazzled to behold Babaji. The great guru had materialized himself in a recess of the cave. Overjoyed to see him again after many years, I prostrated myself at his holy feet. "I called you here," Babaji went on. "That is why you lost your way and were led to my temporary abode in this cave. It is a long time since our last meeting. I am pleased to greet you once more. The deathless master blessed me with some words of spiritual help, then added, I give you a message for Yogananda. He will pay you a visit on his return to India. Many matters connected with his guru and with the surviving disciples of Lahiri will keep Yogananda fully occupied. Tell him, then, that I won't see him this time, as he is eagerly hoping, but I shall see him on some other occasion." I was deeply touched to receive from Keshabananda's lips this consoling promise from Babaji. A certain hurt in my heart vanished. I grieved no longer that, even as Sri Yukteswar had hinted, Babaji did not appear at the Kumbhamela. Spending one night as guests of the ashram, our party set out the following afternoon for Calcutta. Riding over a bridge of the Jumna River, we enjoyed a magnificent view of the skyline of Brindaban just as the sun set fire to the sky, a veritable furnace of Vulcan in color, reflected below us in the still waters. The Jumna beach is hallowed by memories of the child Sri Krishna. Here he engaged with innocent sweetness in his lilas, plays, with the gopis, maids, exemplifying the supernal love which ever exists between a divine incarnation and his devotees. The life of Lord Krishna has been misunderstood by many Western commentators. Scriptural allegory is baffling to literal minds. A hilarious blunder by a translator will illustrate this point. The story concerns an inspired medieval saint, the cobbler Ravidas, who sang in the simple terms of his own trade of the spiritual glory hidden in all mankind. Under the vast vault of blue lives the divinity clothed in hide. One turns aside to hide a smile on hearing the pedestrian interpretation given to Ravida's poem by a Western writer. He afterwards built a hut, set up in it an idol which he made from a hide, and applied himself to its worship. Ravida's was a brother disciple of the great Kabir. One of Ravida's exalted chelas was the Rani of Chitta. She invited a large number of Brahmins to a feast in honor of her teacher, but they refused to eat with a lowly cobbler. As they sat down in dignified aloofness to eat their own uncontaminated meal, lo! Each Brahmin found at his side the form of Ravidas. This mass vision accomplished a widespread spiritual revival in Chitta. In a few days our little group reached Calcutta. Eager to see Sri Yukteswar, I was disappointed to hear that he had left Serampore and was now in Puri, about 300 miles to the south. Come to Puri Ashram at once. This telegram was sent on March 8 by a brother disciple to Atul Chandra Roy Chowdhury, one of Master's Chelas in Calcutta. News of the message reached my ears. Anguished at its implications, I dropped to my knees and implored God that my guru's life be spared. As I was about to leave Father's home for the train, a divine voice spoke within. Do not go to Puri tonight. Thy prayer cannot be granted. Lord, I said, grief-stricken, thou dost not wish to engage with me in a tug of war at Puri, where thou wilt have to deny my incessant prayers for Master's life. Must he, then, depart for higher duties at thy behest? In obedience to the inward command, I did not leave that night for Puri. The following evening I set out for the train, On the way, at 7 o'clock, a black astral cloud suddenly covered the sky. Later, while the train roared toward Puri, a vision of Sri Yukteswar appeared before me. He was sitting, very grave of countenance, with a light on each side. "Is it all over?" I lifted my arms beseechingly. He nodded, then slowly vanished. As I stood on the Puri train platform the following morning, still hoping against hope, an unknown man approached me. "Have you heard that your master is gone?" He left me without another word. I never discovered who he was nor how he had known where to find me. Stunned, I swayed against the platform wall, realizing that in diverse ways my guru was trying to convey to me the devastating news. Seething with rebellion, my soul was like a volcano. By the time I reached the Puri Hermitage, I was nearing collapse. The inner voice was tenderly repeating, "Collect yourself. Be calm." I entered the ashram room where Master's body, unimaginably lifelike, was sitting in the lotus posture, a picture of health and loveliness. A short time before his passing, my guru had been slightly ill with fever, but before the day of his ascension into the infinite, his body had become completely well. No matter how often I looked at his dear form, I could not realize that its life had departed. His skin was smooth and soft, in his face was a beatific expression of tranquility. He had consciously relinquished his body at the hour of mystic summoning. "The Lion of Bengal is gone," I cried in a daze. I conducted the solemn rites on March 10th. Sri Yukteswar was buried with the ancient rituals of the Swamis in the garden of his Puri ashram. His disciples later arrived from far and near to honor their guru at a vernal equinox memorial service. The Amrita Bazar Patrika, leading newspaper of Calcutta, carried his picture and the following report: "The death bandara ceremony for Srimatswami Sri Yukteswar Giri Maharaj, aged 81, took place at Puri on March 21st. Many disciples came down to Puri for the rites. One of the greatest expounders of the Bhagavad Gita, Swami Maharaj was a great disciple of Yogiraj Sri Shyamacharan Lahiri Mahasaya of Benares. Swami Maharaj was the founder of several Yogoda Satsanga, self-realization fellowship, centers in India, and was the great inspiration behind the yoga movement which was carried to the West by Swami Yogananda, his principal disciple. It was Sri Yukteswarji's prophetic powers and deep realization that inspired Swami Yogananda to cross the oceans and spread in America the message of the masters of India. His interpretations of the Bhagavad Gita and other scriptures testify to the depth of Sri Yukteswarji's command of the philosophy, both Eastern and Western, and remain as an eye-opener for the unity between Orient and Occident. As he believed in the unity of all religious faiths, Sri Yukteswar Maharaj established Sadhu Sabha, Society of Saints, with the cooperation of leaders of various sects and faiths, for the inculcation of a scientific spirit in religion. At the time of his demise, he nominated Swami Yogananda his successor as the president of Sadhu Sabha. India is really poorer today by the passing of such a great man. May all fortunate enough to have come near him inculcate in themselves the true spirit of India's culture and sadhana which was personified in him. I returned to Calcutta, not trusting myself as yet to go to the Serampore Hermitage with its sacred memories. I summoned Prafulla, Sri Yukteswar's little disciple in Serampore, and made arrangements for him to enter the Ranchi school. "The morning you left for the Allahabad Mela," Prafulla told me, "Master dropped heavily on the Devonport. Yogananda is gone," he cried. "Yogananda is gone," he added cryptically. "I shall have to tell him some other way." He sat then for hours in silence. My days were filled with lectures, classes, interviews, and reunions with old friends. Beneath a hollow smile and a life of ceaseless activity, a stream of black brooding polluted the inner river of bliss which for so many years had meandered under the sands of all my perceptions. "Where has that divine sage gone?" I cried silently from the depths of a tormented spirit. No answer came. "It is best that Master has completed his union with the cosmic beloved," my mind assured me. "He is eternally glowing in the dominion of deathlessness. Never again may you see him in the old Serampore mansion, my heart lamented. No longer may you bring your friends to meet him, or proudly say, "Behold, the six Indias Jnanavatar." Mr. Wright made arrangements for our party to sail from Bombay for the West in early June. After a fortnight in male farewell banquets and speeches at Calcutta, Miss Bletch, Mr. Wright and myself left in the Ford for Bombay. On our arrival, the ship authorities asked us to cancel our passage, as no room could be found for the Ford, which we would need again in Europe. "Never mind," I said gloomily to Mr. Wright. "I want to return once more to Puri." I silently added, "Let my tears once again water the grave of my guru." Chapter 43. The Resurrection of Sri Yukteswar. Lord Krishna. The glorious form of the Avatar appeared in a shimmering blaze as I sat in my room at the Regent Hotel in Bombay. Shining over the roof of a high building across the street, the ineffable vision had suddenly burst on my sight as I gazed out of my long open third-story window. The divine figure waved to me, smiling and nodding in greeting. When I could not understand the exact message of Lord Krishna, he departed with a gesture of blessing. Wondrously uplifted, I felt that some spiritual event was presaged. My Western voyage had, for the time being, been cancelled. I was scheduled for several public addresses in Bombay before leaving on a return visit to Bengal. Sitting on my bed in the Bombay Hotel at 3 o'clock in the afternoon of June 19, 1936, 1 week after the vision of Krishna, I was roused from my meditation by a beatific light. Before my open and astonished eyes, the whole room was transformed into a strange world, the sunlight transmuted into supernal splendor. Waves of rapture engulfed me as I beheld the flesh and blood form of Sri Yukteswar. "My son," Master spoke tenderly, on his face an angel bewitching smile. For the first time in my life I did not kneel at his feet in greeting but instantly advanced to gather him hungrily in my arms. Moment of moments. The anguish of past months was toll I counted weightless against the torrential bliss now descending. "Master mine, beloved of my heart, why did you leave me?" I was incoherent in an excess of joy. "Why did you let me go to the Kumbh? How bitterly have I blamed myself for leaving you. I did not want to interfere with your happy anticipation of seeing the pilgrimage spot where first I met Babaji. I left you only for a little while, am I not with you again? But is it you, Master, the same Lion of God? Are you wearing a body like the one I buried beneath the cruel Puri sands?" "Yes, my child, I am the same. This is a flesh and blood body. Though I see it as ethereal, to your sight it is physical. From the cosmic atoms I created an entirely new body, exactly like that cosmic dream physical body which you laid beneath the dream sands at Puri in your dream world. I am in truth resurrected not on Earth but on an astral planet. Its inhabitants are better able than earthly humanity to meet my lofty standards. The you and your exalted loved ones shall someday come to be with me. Deathless Guru, tell me more." Master gave a quick, mirthful chuckle. "Please, dear one," he said, "won't you relax your hold a little? Only a little." I had been embracing him with an octopus grip. I could detect the same faint, fragrant, natural odor which had been characteristic of his body before. The thrilling touch of his divine flesh still persists around the inner sides of my arms and in my palms whenever I recall those glorious hours. As prophets are sent on earth to help men work out their physical karma, so I have been directed by God to serve on an astral planet as a savior, Sri Yukteswar explained. "It is called Hiranyaloka or Illumined Astral Planet. There I am aiding advanced beings to rid themselves of astral karma and thus attain liberation from astral rebirths. The dwellers on Hiranyaloka are highly developed spiritually, all of them had acquired, in their last earth incarnation, the meditation-given power of consciously leaving their physical bodies at death. No one can enter Hiranyaloka unless he has passed on earth beyond the state of Sabbikalpa Samadhi into the higher state of Nirbhikalpa Samadhi. The Hiranyaloka inhabitants have already passed through the ordinary astral spheres, where nearly all beings from Earth must go at death, There they worked out many seeds of their past actions in the astral worlds. None but advanced beings can perform such redemptive work effectually in the astral worlds. Then, in order to free their souls more fully from the cocoon of karmic traces lodged in their astral bodies, these higher beings were drawn by cosmic law to be reborn with new astral bodies on Hiranyaloka, the astral sun or heaven, where I have resurrected to help them. There are also highly advanced beings on Hiranyaloka who have come from the superior, subtler, causal world. My mind was now in such perfect attunement with my Guru's that he was conveying his word pictures to me partly by speech and partly by thought transference. I was thus quickly receiving his idea tabloids. You have read in the scriptures, Master went on, that God encased the human soul successively in three bodies: the idea, or causal, body, the subtle astral body, seat of man's mental and emotional natures, and the gross physical body. On earth a man is equipped with his physical senses. An astral being works with his consciousness and feelings and a body made of life drons. A causal bodied being remains in the blissful realm of ideas. My work is with those astral beings who are preparing to enter the causal world. Adorable Master, please tell me more about the astral cosmos. Though I had slightly relaxed my embrace at Sri Yukteswar's request, my arms were still around him. Treasure beyond all treasures, my guru who had laughed at death to reach me. There are many astral planets, teeming with astral beings, Master began. The inhabitants use astral planes, or masses of light, to travel from one planet to another, faster than electricity and radioactive energies. The astral universe, made of various subtle vibrations of light and color, is hundreds of times larger than the material cosmos. The entire physical creation hangs like a little solid basket under the huge luminous balloon of the astral sphere. Just as many physical suns and stars roam in space, so there are also countless astral solar and stellar systems. Their planets have astral suns and moons, more beautiful than the physical ones. The astral luminaries resemble the aurora borealis, the sunny astral aurora being more dazzling than the mild red moon aurora. The astral day and night are longer than those of Earth. The astral world is infinitely beautiful, clean, pure, and orderly. There are no dead planets or barren lands. The terrestrial blemishes, weeds, bacteria, insects, snakes are absent. Unlike the variable climates and seasons of the Earth, the astral planets maintain the even temperature of an eternal spring, with occasional luminous white snow and rain of many colored lights. Astral planets abound in opal lakes and bright seas and rainbow rivers. The ordinary astral universe, not the subtler astral heaven of Hiranyaloka, is peopled with millions of astral beings who have come, more or less recently, from the Earth, and also with myriads of fairies, mermaids, fishes, animals, goblins, gnomes, demigods and spirits, all residing on different astral planets in accordance with karmic qualifications. Various spheric mansions or vibratory regions are provided for good and evil spirits. Good ones can travel freely, but the evil spirits are confined to limited zones. In the same way that human beings live on the surface of the earth, worms inside the soil, fish in water, and birds in air, so astral beings of different grades are assigned to suitable vibratory quarters. Among the fallen dark angels expelled from other worlds, friction and war take place with life-tronic bombs or mental mantric vibratory rays. These beings dwell in the gloom-drenched regions of the lower astral cosmos, working out their evil karma. In the vast realms above the dark astral prison, all is shining and beautiful. The astral cosmos is more naturally attuned than the earth to the divine will and plan of perfection. Every astral object is manifested primarily by the will of God, and partially by the will call of astral beings. They possess the power of modifying or enhancing the grace and form of anything already created by the Lord. He has given his astral children the freedom and privilege of changing or improving at will the astral cosmos. On earth a solid must be transformed into liquid or other form through natural or chemical processes, but astral solids are changed into astral liquids, gases, or energy solely and instantly by the will of the inhabitants. The earth is dark with warfare and murder in the sea, land, and air, my guru continued, but the astral realms know a happy harmony and equality. Astral beings dematerialize or materialize their forms at will. Flowers or fish or animals can metamorphose themselves, for a time, into astral men. All astral beings are free to assume any form, and can easily commune together. No fixed, definite, natural law hems them round any astral tree, for example, can be successfully asked to produce an astral mango or other desired fruit, flower, or indeed any other object. Certain karmic restrictions are present, but there are no distinctions in the astral world about desirability of various forms. Everything is vibrant with God's creative light. No one is born of woman, offspring are materialized by astral beings through the help of their cosmic will into specially patterned, astrally condensed forms. The recently physically disembodied being arrives in an astral family through invitation, drawn by similar mental and spiritual tendencies. The astral body is not subject to cold or heat or other natural conditions. The anatomy includes an astral brain, or the thousand-petaled lotus of light, and six awakened centers in the Sushumna, or astral cerebrospinal axis. The heart draws cosmic energy as well as light from the astral brain, and pumps it to the astral nerves and body cells, or lifetrons. Astral beings can affect their bodies by lifetronic force or by mantric vibrations. The astral body is an exact counterpart of the last physical form. Astral beings retain the same appearance which they possessed in youth in their previous earthly sojourn. Occasionally an astral being chooses, like myself, to retain his old age appearance. Master, emanating the very essence of youth, chuckled merrily. Unlike the spatial, three-dimensional physical world cognized only by the five senses, the astral spheres are visible to the all-inclusive sixth sense intuition, Sri Yukteswar went on. By sheer intuitional feeling, all astral beings see, hear, smell, taste, and touch. They possess three eyes, two of which are partly closed. The third and chief astral eye, vertically placed on the forehead, is open. Astral beings have all the outer sensory organs, ears, eyes, nose, tongue, and skin, but they employ the intuitional sense to experience sensations through any part of the body. They can see through the ear, or nose, or skin. They are able to hear through the eyes or tongue, and can taste through the ears or skin, and so forth. Man's physical body is exposed to countless dangers, and is easily hurt or maimed. The ethereal astral body may occasionally be cut or bruised but is healed at once by mere willing. Garudeva, are all astral persons beautiful? Beauty in the astral world is known to be a spiritual quality, and not an outward conformation, Sri Yukteswar replied. Astral beings therefore attach little importance to facial features. They have the privilege, however, of costuming themselves at will with new, colorful, astrally materialized bodies. Just as worldly men don new array for gala events, so astral beings find occasions to bedeck themselves in specially designed forms. Joyous astral festivities on the higher astral planets like Hiranyaloka take place when a being is liberated from the astral world through spiritual advancement, and is therefore ready to enter the heaven of the causal world. On such occasions the invisible Heavenly Father, and the saints who are merged in him, materialize themselves into bodies of their own choice and join the astral celebration. In order to please his beloved devotee, the Lord takes any desired form. If the devotee worshipped through devotion, he sees God as the Divine Mother. To Jesus, the Father aspect of the Infinite One was appealing beyond other conceptions. The individuality with which the Creator has endowed each of his creatures makes every conceivable and inconceivable demand on the Lord's versatility. My Guru and I laughed happily together. Friends of other lives easily recognize one another in the astral world, Sri Yukteswar went on in his beautiful, flute-like voice. Rejoicing at the immortality of friendship, they realize the indestructibility of love, often doubted at the time of the sad, delusive partings of earthly life. The intuition of astral beings pierces through the veil and observes human activities on Earth, but man cannot view the astral world unless his sixth sense is somewhat developed. Thousands of Earth dwellers have momentarily glimpsed an astral being or an astral world. The advanced beings on Hiranyaloka remain mostly awake in ecstasy during the long astral day and night, helping to work out intricate problems of cosmic government and the redemption of prodigal sons, earthbound souls. When the Hiranyaloka beings sleep, they have occasional dream-like astral visions. Their minds are usually engrossed in the conscious state of highest nirvikalpa bliss. Inhabitants in all parts of the astral worlds are still subject to mental agonies. The sensitive minds of the higher beings on planets like Hiranyaloka feel keen pain if any mistake is made in conduct or perception of truth. These advanced beings endeavor to attune their every act and thought with the perfection of spiritual law. Communication among the astral inhabitants is held entirely by astral telepathy and television. There is none of the confusion and misunderstanding of the written and spoken word which earth dwellers must endure. Just as persons on the cinema screen appear to move and act through a series of light pictures, and do not actually breathe, so the astral beings walk and work as intelligently guided and coordinated images of light, without the necessity of drawing power from oxygen. Man depends upon solids, liquids, gases, and energy for sustenance. Astral beings sustain themselves principally by cosmic light. Master mine, do astral beings eat anything? I was drinking in his marvelous elucidations with the receptivity of all my faculties, mind, heart, soul. Superconscious perceptions of truth are permanently real and changeless, while fleeting sense experiences and impressions are never more than temporarily or relatively true, and soon lose in memory all their vividness. My guru's words were so penetratingly imprinted on the parchment of my being that at any time, by transferring my mind to the superconscious state, I can clearly relive the divine experience. Luminous ray-like vegetables abound in the astral soils, he answered. The astral beings consume vegetables, and drink a nectar flowing from glorious fountains of light and from astral brooks and rivers. Just as invisible images of persons on the earth can be dug out of the ether and made visible by a television apparatus, later being dismissed again into space, so the God created, unseen astral blueprints of vegetables and plants floating in the ether are precipitated on an astral planet by the will of its inhabitants. In the same way, from the wildest fancy of these beings, whole gardens of fragrant flowers are materialized, returning later to the etheric invisibility. Although dwellers on the heavenly planets like Hiranyaloka are almost freed from any necessity of eating, still higher is the unconditioned existence of almost completely liberated souls in the causal world, who eat nothing save the manna of bliss. The earth-liberated astral being meets a multitude of relatives, fathers, mothers, wives, husbands, and friends, acquired during different incarnations on Earth, as they appear from time to time in various parts of the astral realms. He is therefore at a loss to understand whom to love especially. He learns in this way to give a divine and equal love to all, as children and individualized expressions of God. Though the outward appearance of loved ones may have changed, more or less according to the development of new qualities in the latest life of any particular soul, the astral being employs his unerring intuition to recognize all those once dear to him in other planes of existence, and to welcome them to their new astral home. Because every atom in creation is inextinguishably dowered with individuality, an astral friend will be recognized no matter what costume he may don, even as on Earth an actor's identity is discoverable by close observation despite any disguise. The span of life in the astral world is much longer than on Earth. A normal advanced astral being's average life period is from 500 to 1000 years, measured in accordance with earthly standards of time. As certain redwood trees outlive most trees by millenniums, or as some yogis live several hundred years though most men die before the age of 60, so some astral beings live much longer than the usual span of astral existence. Visitors to the astral world dweller for a longer or shorter period in accordance with the weight of their physical karma, which draws them back to Earth within a specified time. The astral being does not have to contend painfully with death at the time of shedding his luminous body.